Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Post Credit Podcast. I am your host, Eric Italiano, senior writer at BroBible.com. Today, as always, I am joined by my co-host, Cade Onder. We have been busy. My man Cade has been playing Spider-Man 2. He's been playing Alan Wake 2. All sorts of stuff going on in what is, he says, is the best gaming year in a long time. As for what we've got going on my end today, we're going to be talking about episode 4, season 2 of Loki, one of what might turn out to be one of the most consequential hours in the MCU in some time. And then finally, I am speaking to Francis Lawrence, the director of Constantine, I Am Legend, and a bunch of Hunger Games films. Next week, I also am going to be having on the show Sean Levy for his new Netflix series, All the Light We Cannot See. Levy, of course, as you I'm sure have seen his name everywhere this week, is the director of Deadpool 3 and an upcoming Star Wars film. I'm debating because the number one thing that I hate doing is like pounding these guys with the same thing that they've heard over and over and over again. So I think when I talk to Sean, I'm going to say, hey, Sean, is there something that you want to ask me about Deadpool 3 and Star Wars?
It's a good question. It is, because then you might be able to get him to like wiggle on something, because you're like, well, I want to see this.
Yeah, exactly. Because the poor guy, I like, look, they have great jobs, they get paid well, but I do feel bad for these people. Just
the press runs awful.
Every 2 hours, I've been seeing Deadpool 3 is this, Deadpool 3 is that, and everyone is asking the same fucking question. Nevertheless, before all of that, Cade is going to share his thoughts on Spider-Man 2. If not the best game of the year, I'd say certainly the biggest, right? I mean, Starfield.
Yeah.
I will say my hype for Starfield did die off pretty quick. I do see the flaws. The fact that FIFA, which is my game, came out a few weeks later did not help. But yeah, I totally see kind of where it falls short. But I still think in terms of hype and scope, it was probably one of the two games of the year. But I think Spider-Man 2, given just the general conversation I've seen in the culture, it has sort of broken through in a way that most games don't do.
Commercially, right? Yeah, like it is... I have seen
drop
people
some stats on me, kid.
We don't have anything too concrete quite yet, because it's been 1 week as of today. So I imagine sometime this month or early next month we'll start to hear more specifics. But it is the fastest selling PlayStation exclusive in history. In the first 24 hours, sold over 2.5 million copies, which is crazy. Especially when you think about, there's only probably 20 to 30 million PS5s out there right now, you know, because of the shortage and all that at the start. But it's a lot of people, and that's only going to grow, especially as we get into the holiday season. More people buy these. They're bundling it in with the PS5 and all that stuff. It's fucking massive, and it's not going to go. I saw Five Nights at Freddy's last night. There was a trailer for Spider-Man 2 before the movie. It was really cool seeing that
I've
on the big screen.
I've never seen that before. It was really cool. I've literally
the marketing
never seen that before.
Crazy. And it sounds like there may be some DLC somewhere along the way. So this game probably will not be done for a while.
They need it to last at least till Wolverine comes out, right? I mean, I feel like that's kind of the no-brainer there.
Yeah, and the rumors have always been that sounds like a late 2024 game, early 2025 maybe.
Oh, that's
so,
sooner than I thought, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, they've had a separate like team at Insomniac working on Wolverine, and now all the Spider-Man people are moving over to Wolverine. But again, that's just a rumor. We don't know for sure. But yeah, I would say maybe they'll have like a DLC maybe in the spring or something. That would be really cool. They've suggested... there's a Daredevil Easter egg in the game where his office was in the first game and you could find it. And in this one, it has moved. And they said in an interview, they're like, oh, It's nice that you notice that. Maybe there's something there. And you're like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And there's all these other side quests in the game that.
Dude, I saw that you could find the across the Spider-Verse window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a whole side quest.
That's
yeah.
just in. Oh wow.
So wow. We can get into that because it's actually really interesting. So you collect all these spider robots around the map, right? And when you do that, you're like, these belong to someone else. These aren't mine. And once you find them all, Genki sends you over to this alleyway. He's like, there's a signal coming from here. And then when you get there, big portal opens. And this woman, Delilah, comes in and she says, I need those. I'm taking them. And if Miguel comes looking for them, tell him Finders Keepers. And then she disappears. Delilah is a character from Across the Spider-Verse that got cut. So it's an interesting thing. I haven't, they apparently explained this today in an interview and I haven't read it, so I may be behind on this, but I would imagine this was a quest that was planned alongside the movie, and then they're like, oh, we got it, and they already developed the quest, and like, all right, well, we're keeping it, and maybe it'll come back around later, but I think there's probably more to come on that front as well.
All right, so tell me your just general kind of 1 minute long thoughts on the game.
I think on a gameplay level, the best superhero game I've ever played. It is fantastic. Traversal is fantastic. The web swing was perfect in the first game, right? It's even better here. You got the web wings. You're moving through the city at light speed. It's just so much fun. There's so much variety. It's impossible to go back. It feels too stiff in the old games now. It's like, this is perfect. I don't know how you do it better in the third game. They've set themselves up with an impossible problem. So that's a high bar already. Narratively, it has a lot of pacing issues. I think the game takes too long to get going. It's like 15-ish hours, which isn't bad, but they spend too much time kind of dilly-dallying and not giving enough time to Kraven nor Venom. So you kind of have like an unsatisfying situation with both of them where you're like, you're just about there. If you had focused on one over the other, probably would have been fine. And the other issue is Kraven shows up. You only get one fight with him, and you're fighting his goons most of the time. It would have been better if there were like a few boss fights with him throughout the game or something. But
it's interesting not. Because you sound largely let down.
It's the first game story is so high for me. Did you play it?
Yes, I did.
It's fantastic, right?
2018. It's been a long time now, but yes, I do. I do love it.
I loved that story. And so it was always going to be a high bar to meet that again.
Right. Doc Ock and
Aunt May and all that stuff. There's a lot of elements Ant-Man. In here. Aunt May.
Oh. I was like, whoa, did I play it?
So there's just a lot of elements. It's like I was happy enough with it. But I was like, I wanted a little bit more. It was just, it needed to be a little tighter, and that would have been solid.
So that's kind of what it gets most right and wrong. Talk to me about your favorite villain.
Ooh, Kraven. Like, it's so frustrating because Kraven is really good in the game, but he's just not interacting with Spider-Man very much, which is always the problem with villains and these kinds of things. It's like, you can't have them interact with the hero too much because otherwise they just kill each other right away, right? He makes a very big impression. He, without spoiling specifics, he kills some villains from the Marvel Universe. And you're like, oh, this guy means business. And
Marvel Universe?
Yeah, so well, Spider-Man.
Oh, okay, okay.
Beep! I mean, it's fine. It's implied.
It's okay.
But on top of that, he also just, you know, kind of lays Spider-Man out as well. So, like, he makes a good impression, but you just don't get enough of him, I don't think. But his whole through line, his narrative is really cool. I don't know that Venom gets his time to shine necessarily. He does and he doesn't.
That's crazy because he's, like, the thing that they're selling it on.
Yeah, and he just doesn't have a lot of screen time. When he shows up, he makes an impression. You're like, oh, shit, this is what I wanted. But then it kind of disappears.
Were you right?
About who he is?
No, right? You weren't.
I was not. No. unfortunately.
All right, then you said that you still think, despite your problems with it, you still thought that this is the best superhero game you've played.
Yeah, absolutely. It just
better
it's
than
so cliche.
Arkham 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Arkham Knight is like a pretty great gameplay experience as well, and Arkham City I think is the best of those Batman games, like narratively. And so I would say on a narrative level, I would say maybe Arkham City still is beating out Spider-Man 2, but on a pure superhero fantasy, as a kid, I want to be Spider-Man thing, Spider-Man 2 hits all the marks.
And then I guess the final thing that I want to ask that is not in our doc, so sorry for this.
Ooh,
are we getting more of these, you know, X-Men, the Suicide Squad game, that has not come out yet, right?
It comes out in January or February.
Gotham Knights supposedly was a disaster.
Yeah.
Teasing some kind of Daredevil. Maybe it's a DLC. Perhaps its own game. Why aren't there more of these? I would play every single one. Whether it's Batman, Superman, The Flash, Spider-Man, X-Men. Literally anyone that came out. If it got good enough reviews, I'd play it, which I'm sure is the thought of not just gaming fans, but film fans as well. So, like, where are we at with these?
I will say, go play the Guardians of the Galaxy game if you haven't.
I've played that as well.
Amazing. Yeah, fantastic. Good. Great.
Right, exactly. But that's my point, right? Like, I'll play the shit out of these games.
Yeah. The problem is they take so long to fucking make, right? Is like, that's the biggest thing. Because they take a long time to make. I mean, like...
don't all games? Like, what, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I'll tell you right now what's announced. Black Panther.
Okay.
Iron Man.
Right.
A Captain America Black Panther game, which is separate from the other Black Panther game. Yeah. Uh-huh. We don't know too much about the DC's plans, especially now that they're kind of doing the DC Universe thing where they want
James
everything
Gunn.
To be
in. Long-time fan of the show, James Gunn, famously. More games, please.
Yeah, exactly. So it sounds like they'll have some things to do that will cross over into that universe, which is interesting. But for Marvel, I think those are the ones we know of right now. And I'm sure, that, again, there are more, right? They're always planning things. And but yeah, I mean, they just take a long fucking time to make. You got to make a story that's like 20 plus hours long. You got to get people in to come act them. You got to design the combat, design the worlds, design side content. You know, it's a big undertaking. And the fidelity and the especially, I mean, people are bitching about the stupidest shit with this game. Like,
but the money is clearly there.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Like, I'm sure if they all had their way, they'd all be out tomorrow. But like, you want to make sure, because I mean, there was a time where they were fucking rushing these things out like every 2 months, you know, to tie in with every superhero movie, and they were garbage. So we don't want that again.
I mean, the ideal for me is I'm not a VR guy, but if our kids are strapping in to go fight crime on the streets of Gotham, that system is mine. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, there is a Batman Arkham VR game. It's more of a detective thing. Yeah.
But I'm saying, like, that is where gaming is going, right?
Definitely on some level. I'm sure, you know, we have some cool VR Star Wars games, some cool VR Walking Dead games and other stuff. I mean,
it's not there yet.
It's only a matter of time, though, I think. We're getting pretty close. Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we are talking about episode 4 of Loki. All right, Loki, episode 4. This is the last one that journalists got. So from this point forward, I am in the dark, just as you, Cade. I watched this weeks ago. I rewatched it this week. This was part of my general review when I talked about it. So talk to me about where you're at with this show since we last spoke. Famed MCU show hater.
Just the problem with these fucking shows is that, and this is not a Loki season 2 problem, is that they meander too much. They fucking dilly dally. I don't feel the momentum. I don't feel the urgency of anything. This one's like, we're going, we're moving, we're going to a new place every fucking episode. We're doing something weird. There is an energy and a momentum behind there. It's like the show is strapped to a fucking rocket, right? And this is the episode where the rocket explodes.
And I want to point out, not like a finely tuned one. One of those like cartoon ones that are like,
yeah, it's exactly what I was thinking.
Out of control. Yeah.
Exactly. And like I just said, like this is the episode where the rocket explodes and some crazy shit happens. And yeah, I'm on board. Like there's been no episode of this show where I've been like, all right, you know, maybe the next one will be better. Like, and I felt that with all the other Marvel shows where I'm like, this episode just doesn't need to fucking exist. You're hitting a quota.
That's why what you're saying relates directly to reports that have come out in the last few weeks, reports that have come out today, i.e. Marvel revamping how they do shows. They are going to build it from the ground up. They are bringing in the revolutionary concept of consistent showrunners and directors. Point being, the guys largely spearheading season two of this show, they directed 1, 4, 5, 6. Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead were just tapped to direct multiple episodes of Daredevil Born Again. So what I think you're touching on is the fact that even when it might be narratively treading water a bit, so here's what our friend B says about season two. He's probably not as high on it as we are, but his complaint is sort of in direct contrast of what you're saying. He says, I don't know, man. I still like season two, but the last two episodes have been a lot of chaotic running around to solve, quote, the big sci-fi problem. I still don't have any real sense of how the TVA chaos is impacting anything real in the world or how the Kang variants even matter that much. But I love characters, comma, sense of humor, comma, and style. And I think that that's the point, is that even when something is sort of narratively inert, this show is so well textured that you're okay kind of just hanging out and running in place with these people. So I think ultimately that is what's leading Marvel back to this. And this just shows like how up their own ass they are. Their new move is to go back to the way the TV was made. You know what I mean? Like, hey, congrats, guys. You really cracked the fucking code.
We reinvented television.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I'm glad that they're doing it. And I think that this show is probably a case study. I bet you they saw this and were like, whoa, a consistent vision. Holy shit. And what's funny is that Benson and Moorhead did Moon Knight stuff, and you couldn't tell their work from a fucking piss in the wind because it was so Marvel-ified. But now it's like, this is the clear creation of two people who have an idea in mind. So the fact that they're giving them Daredevil 2, I think speaks to their confidence in where the show was going because they directed the final two as well. So with all that said, let's dive into some of the major talking points of episode four.
Can I say one thing? Of course. Brandon had
anything as you want, though.
Brandon had a really good point about not seeing the impact of this on the world. And I think they had an opportunity too that they missed, which is, I think it's the second episode where you see these timelines breaking or whatever. And there's like a woman, I forget her name, the TVA
She's
woman.
Like, those are all people.
Those are people. And I'm like, okay,
show it.
Show me, don't tell. I mean, the best example I could think of was The Force Awakens, when that fucking Starkiller base annihilates Coruscant or whatever it is and all those other planets, and you see from the perspective of those people this fucking laser coming down to annihilate them. Show me. I don't know if there's a good visual way to show a universe like just kind of disappearing.
It's just kind of like a snap dusting, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it would be there's a way.
I do get your point that they are doing a lot of just saying, oh no, this is bad, but not actually showing us why this is
exactly
bad. All right, let's go on to one of the major points of episode four, and that is, you know, the Jonathan Majors thing is complicated. The way that episode four ends may be the way that the MCU finds its way out. I truly don't know, but let's just assess his performance, what it is. I have been loving the sort of Victor Timely arc. I think his babbling, his quirkiness, his fear kind of juxtaposed against his desire to do good and be brave is a very rich theme, because as somebody who can have a hard time with getting out the words he wants to say, wanting to do good and be brave is extremely hard when you literally cannot even communicate it. So the fact that that this character is not only doing so, but doing so in the face of like godly powers being like, you're a bad man, you're going to do bad things. And him being like, that's not me, I haven't done those things. In fact, I want to do the opposite of that, I think is a very thematically rich idea. And it's something that the first thing I thought of was Terminator 2. Where they go to that guy's house who is like the Skynet guy. He's got the family and the wife and kids, and Arnold is ready to kill him. I don't know exactly if that's why he stops him, but that's something that they play on there. He's like, I haven't done those things yet. And then he goes on to try to help. So I love that idea. I love his performance of it and sort of how it's flipping the idea of Kang on its head. The idea that Kang that we were presented with at first was he who remains was there are millions of me and they're all worse. This is the idea of, well, what if they aren't? What happens before that point? And I think that that's really, really strong stuff, especially for a franchise that has struggled with villains, largely doesn't have anti-heroes. This is why I've always said a Doctor Doom kind of show would work, because you really feel for the guy. You know he's going to become bad, but you could relate to the helplessness of being like, but I'm not that guy yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree with everything you're saying. Like, Kang is, I liked him in Ant-Man. I liked him in Loki season one. And every time we've gotten something a little different. I think that's a way to keep it fresh while knowing there's a through line here between all these guys, right? And I think, you know, Jonathan Majors, like, it's unfortunate when an actor does something really shitty, right? And, you know, like, someone allegedly, yes. Like, Kevin Spacey and all that stuff was, like, really fucking annoying because I'm a big House of Cards fan. And I was like, great. That's awesome. Like, I fucking hate this. There's no good thing to come out of this. And so it's always super frustrating, but you can still acknowledge that, yes, they gave a good performance. And I think he is really good in all of this with, again, being menacing and scary, but also being this quirky guy who's like the fucking cowardly lion. Like, it's like a really cool take, and showing what he will
his
become
line
eventually.
Being like, sir, I'm from Chicago. Like, yeah.
And he talks in this like sing-songy way of like almost very, very old school and like, you know, of the time that he's ripped out of. And I think I've mentioned this before. He has this almost Shakespearean approach when he's playing the more villainous Kang. And so to they're doing all these weird, like out of time things is really cool. And I don't know what they'll do with Kang in the future, especially because Jonathan Majors is this, like, big, like, festival movie of, like, the last year or whatever. Magazine Dreams was taken off their release schedule today.
It was.
I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's, like, we're just waiting to see or what, but...
If I was a betting man, do you know betting odds?
Generally, yeah.
Like, do you know how... I would say odds that his career are cooked are probably at, like, minus 185, 200. That's kind of how...
Is that good or bad?
So that's kind of a 2-to-1 odds. Okay. So you would have to bet $200 to win $1.
Okay.
Which means I think it's more likely than not. Because just the way that... I mean... Cooked in the sense of, like, do I think he's going to go to jail? I have no idea. I'm not a fucking lawyer, but cooked in the sense of, is the most successful franchise of all time going to hinge their future on him? Yeah, I'd say that ship is not quite yet sailed, but it's looking delayed.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. It's just like, the other thing I remember hearing was, like, it's not just about what he's going to court for, but, like, he was apparently not super cool on sets of things. So, like, people had problems with him professionally, too. So, it's just, like, all this stuff is just, like, another reason to just be, like, you're kind of a fucking problem. And if you don't bring a good vibe to the set, why would we want you here for when we're going to have Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans, all these guys come back for Secret Wars and stuff, and you're going to piss them all off, right? Like, nobody wants that. It's just like, logistically, it just sounds like a fucking nightmare.
And that's why I had asked you guys when the show starts, if we think that they're going to fix it within the show itself. You smartly pointed out to me at the time, we know that it was locked before all this came out. So it doesn't seem like it, but it certainly seems like they are laying the foundation. Okay, moving on. Another part of episode 4 that I want to highlight is Sylvie calling out Mobius for trying to get key lime pie during a time of high stress. I think it speaks to how great Owen Wilson is, was, always will be. His sort of ability to, you know, there's something about becoming an actor who you are playing yourself. We talk about the Robert Downey Jr.'s and the Samuel Jacksons and the Matthew McConaughey's. Mm-hmm. And that is largely associated with great, iconic, highly skilled performers where you're so good, we'll let you get away with playing various versions of yourself.
Sure.
Owen Wilson is doing that in the show.
Yeah.
And he's such a fucking warm amazing.
Guy. Yeah. He just wants to eat pie. That's all he wants to do. And I'm down for that. I want to eat pie with Owen Wilson. It's so funny. I remember like writing him off at some point in my life, like probably when I was a snobby teenager and was like, I like cinema.
You grew up during a time, not to make light of it at all, but his not only his career almost came to an end, but his life did too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Tried to kill himself.
Oh, wow.
That's awful. 2008, 2009-ish.
Wow.
Yeah. So awful. That was so. Yeah.
I'm glad we still have him because he's
absolutely
got a great career. I mean, like I think just because this was where what was most visible to me, but I was seeing like movies like Drillbit Taylor, right?
I knew that you were gonna.
So I'm like, I don't know what the fuck is this Owen Wilson guy doing. But then you grow up and you see him in some Woody Allen stuff, and we can talk all day about that, but that's a different story. And whatnot. Yeah. But he's good in that, and he's shown that he's very capable in other movies when he's not doing the kind of crappy Hollywood comedy movie like Hall Pass. That's another one. I don't like that one. But you give him good material, and he's able to show his warmth and his character and his charisma and charm. And he's also, I think, able to ground the insanity of all of this, right? It's like the TVA is a crazy idea, but you just got this guy who you relate to. You're like, yeah, like I said, I do want to eat pie with you. I want to have a sit down and have a conversation. He knows how to mellow out. And I think that's the perfect balance to the absurdity of it all.
But I want to highlight on the flip side of that scene, it makes me like realize how much I enjoy him and everything he's doing in the show. But also what Sylvie says to him serves as sort of a thesis for the MCU and for this show at large. It calls out the absurdity, but also the severeness of it. And it reminded me of the Hulk line from Endgame where they're trying to figure out time travel. And he's like, it either all makes sense or none of it does.
Right.
And I feel like this show is sort of the in-between of that. None of this makes sense. It's all absurd, but at the same time, it's dealing with very fundamental ideas of like self and time. And the consequences, as you've pointed out, while they aren't being displayed as well as they could be, you still understand them. You still understand the implications of a timeline of billions of people dying. So I thought that scene was powerful, not powerful in terms of like I'm crying Oscar awards, but in terms of like speaking to the whole idea of all of this. This is all really fucking stupid, right? And it's all at the end of the day a distraction from what really matters. But the stories that they're telling, you know, that shit counts for something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to maybe jump too far off ahead of your point, but like the moments at the end of this episode where am I supposed to assume all of space and time just imploded? Is that the idea here?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
That's crazy. But you get that moment of this kind of like almost like one shot from each character and seeing their reactions. And everyone's like, oh, like you can see their fucking like heart rise into their throat. And it reminded me of the scene in Infinity War after the snap where like Cap is sitting there and he's like, oh my God, or that moment of realization that they just won or they just lost, I guess. And that was like a very critical moment. And it's like, but I do need to see a larger consequence. I do think, cause that's why that scene works is you see all of the fatalities of that moment in Infinity War. And then you get to see their reactions to it as opposed to they saw one guy they just kind of met die. And I'm like, I need to see more. And so I would hope the next episode has a cold open of like, we're on where, like, wherever universe, and you start seeing some crazy shit happen. Kind of like at the end of Infinity War when you see Samuel L. Jackson's perspective, or at the end of or start of Endgame when you see Hawkeye's perspective, right?
I think that'd be a good lead me right into what I want to talk about next. Where do you think that this is going, both small scale, i.e. next week, and large scale in terms of the MCU as a whole? You kind of touched on what I think this might be. Like, I think that the characters and this, I mean, you want to talk about a shot in the dark, a pure guess. There are little identifications of where we might be going next. I will say that the idea of Loki bringing up his Avengers fight and the whole Tony Stark thing makes me wonder if they're going to send these various characters back to their nexus points, i.e. when Mobius decides to, or is forced to, or is kidnapped to the TVA, when Loki, you know, makes that choice that makes him a good or bad guy. I feel like that might, because I clearly they can't just start from scratch, right? They're not going to be like, all right, here's Iron Man 1 2.0, you know, like that's not where this is going. We're going to have the same characters. We're going to have the same storylines. So how do they build in what seems like a resetting of the clock within a show? And I think that might be it.
Yeah.
I think saying I am 99% sure I'm wrong, but like if I had, but like, how could you guess? That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't think of anything. So, like, that's probably the natural conclusion to make is, like, because I don't know. Like, it's such a fucking bonkers idea. If it were me doing this narrative decision, I'd be like, this is the end of the MCU as we know it. We're rebooting. And, like, it's a natural in-universe reboot. I mean, the comic books do this shit all the time. Right. And obviously, that's not going to happen because they have 40 movies planned. I mean, maybe. I don't know. But there's two episodes to go. It's not like they're going to... That'd be the last episode, right? Like, you don't reboot in with your two final episodes left. But I don't know. It's... I hope it has a larger impact and it's not just quickly swept under the rug because that'd be really fucking boring, and continues to prove that these shows have an issue with not... having larger universe consequences, especially now that we have the Marvels coming out in like 2-3 weeks. But that was supposed to release before this show even came out, I think. So there's probably no connection there.
I will just say that Kevin Feige made comments in a official MCU timeline book that came out this week, literally this week.
Interesting timing.
That said, quote, the timeline presented in this book is specific to the MCU's sacred timeline through phase 4, but as we move forward and dive deeper into the multiverse saga, you never know when timelines may just crash or converge. Parentheses, hint hint / spoiler alert. You combine that with a rumor I've seen on Twitter this week. Spoiler alert, skip ahead 30 seconds if you don't want to hear it, even though it's kind of stupid. I heard that Kelsey Grammer's Beast is going to be appearing
in of all the Marvel's
post-credit scene. But, like, you combine Kevin Feige's comments, the end of Loki this week, and this Kelsey Grammer thing, and it sort of leads into the reboot point. Like, what, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a valid point. I mean, we know Deadpool 3 will also be merging universes and killing universes and stuff. So it seems like now that you kind of start to, I really didn't think about the Beast thing connecting kind of back into this and that whole timeline thing. That starts to make some sense that this does have a bigger implication as to what's going on here. I guess I don't know what to think about it. It's just, I need to see what happens next before I then can say, like, concretely, like, where do we go from here? There's just not enough tangible evidence of what goes next.
All right, let's swing over to my interview with Hunger Games, I Am Legend, and Constantine director Francis Lawrence. Folks, today I am thrilled to be joined by Francis Lawrence, director of films such as Constantine, I Am Legend, multiple films in the Hunger Games franchise, the latest of which, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, hits theaters on November 17th. Thank you so much for your time today, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you.
First question, do you have an MP3 file that you could send me until the soundtrack officially drops? Because that music was great.
No, I know. The music's fantastic. You know, the weird thing is I actually don't. I mean, maybe if I went back in like my email history or something, I could find some, you know, album lineup or something like that. But no, I'm waiting for it to come out on Spotify myself.
I particularly love the track that she sings when she's trying to earn donations. So I'm curious to start with, who were some of the, because the genre is clear, but I'm curious, who are some of the specific people, touchstones, that you sort of used as the sonic ideal for this film?
Okay, so going into this movie, I have to, you know, in all honesty, I didn't have that much knowledge about the sort of country music genre, in truth. And so when I started talking to Suzanne Collins and she said there was a sort of a musical element to it, and then I read the book and I saw the lyrics, we started talking about her reference points, and she recommended that I watch this documentary by Ken Burns on country music, the country music documentary. It's like 16 hours or something. It was during the pandemic. I had plenty of time, but I fell in love with it. I love this documentary. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's amazing. But what was also great is that I actually really fell in love with the era and the genre of music that we're touching on in this. And so I think it's like the second episode of this documentary. We get down into kind of West Virginia, and it's sort of focusing in on like the Carter family, Maybelle Carter, and that sound that comes out of West Virginia and Appalachia. And I just fell in love with it. I play guitar, and I suddenly wanted to learn how to play guitar like Maybelle Carter, and I just loved the sound. And this was in early days of starting to record people and putting out records. And so then we went and we hired Dave Cobb, a great Nashville-based producer and songwriter, who also has a vast knowledge of country music and gets this genre very and this tone specifically. He put together this great little band, and he wrote the chords and the melodies for the music that Suzanne had already written. And it, for me, kind of came together seamlessly. And the next worry, I will say, is Rachel has an amazing voice, but we didn't know if she was going to translate to this kind of music. But the thing is that she got it instantly, like hardly with any coaching from Dave. She was already had a little bit of the dialect going into it, just fully understood and zoned in and got it, and it was amazing. And then could sing honestly live on set. Everything we did in the movie, she sang live.
She's one of those performers that you can't believe a voice so powerful comes out of a body so tiny.
I know. Yeah, it's incredible.
So there's something a bit meta here that I'd like to talk about. What's it like returning to a franchise that not only takes place in a different time period than the one you previously knew, but also at a time when you yourself are in a different time period of your life?
You know, I mean, I have to say that, you know, I didn't think there were going to be any more books, and Suzanne didn't have any plans for anything, and she sort of surprised us with this in 2019, end of 2019, that she was almost done with the book. And when I discovered that it was essentially two things: one, the origin of a villain, which I love those kinds of stories.
I'm going to ask you about that. Don't worry.
But the other part was that we were basically, in essence, making a period piece to the original movies, and I thought that was such a wildly fun challenge. And I love world building. It's one of the things I look for in all the projects that I do. And so the fact that I'm not just kind of recreating the world of Panem, we know I get to sort of create an older version of Panem, and a much more rudimentary version of Panem, that was really, really fun.
So I'm going to be frank here. I have never seen any of these films before. So I'm curious if you think that puts me at an advantage or a disadvantage for enjoying this film, and how you sort of approach that, trying to reach new fans, but also appeasing longtime ones.
The truth is, the way we tried to approach it is that ideally somebody who has not read any of the other books and not seen any of the other movies could come in cold, get into this world, understand the world, follow the story, and have a fulfilling experience, and come out having been entertained, ideally have their thoughts sort of provoked, have them thinking about the themes of the story. I will say there'll be a little bit of a benefit if you were to have seen the other movies.
At one point I'm like, why are they singing? And like, it took me a while to sort of get my grasp in the world, but once I did, and this is me being totally truthful, I was in. So I was impressed by sort of that ability to like appease a new fan to me in what I imagine is the whole reason that the checks were writ was to get franchise fans back in, but it still connected with a new fan.
Well, like that's ideally that's what we want to do. We want to have it work on its own, right? I was going to say that I think that for people who are fans of the books and the other movies, there's another layer that's at play that wouldn't be at play for you, right? Which are all the nods to things in the later movies. There are now, like, if you had seen the other movies and you see this, you're suddenly going to have sort of epiphanies about characters, about character dynamics, about the origins of certain songs. One of the songs in this movie, you probably didn't know, The Hanging Tree.
No, I read it up. I've gone and dug into the lore. I have went back and bought the movies and completely dove in since. So yes, I do know the song.
Yeah, so that one you've heard Katniss sing, but now to go back, you know, 64 years and go, oh, okay, this was created here. We get to see the Hanging Tree. We see the person who created the song. There's people that actually meet at the Hanging Tree. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. But sort of discovering, you know, what District 12 really means to Snow, to understand who Tigress really is and how close Tigress really was with Snow. If you've seen her in Mockingjay Part 2, you would never in a million years know that there's
Hunter
a connection.
Hunter was great, too.
Yeah, she's awesome. I love Hunter.
As a result of me not having seen the films in this, it took me a while to realize that I was watching a movie about a villain, which had a very disorienting effect that I actually really enjoyed. There were choices he makes. I'll bleep this out because I don't want to spoil the film. But when I'm following this character thinking he's a hero, and that decision was so strange. I was like, wait, did I miss something? What's going on here? But then once it clicked to me that it was a villain, it all sort of clicked into place. So talk to me about the challenges and rewards of making an origin story about a character that ultimately ends up villainous versus that classic hero type.
Yeah, I mean, I love those kinds of stories. You know, if you look at, you know, old stories like Macbeth, and you look at stories like, you know, the origins of Darth Vader, or you look at Breaking Bad, you know, I love those stories of people breaking bad. So this was one of my opportunities to do that. The challenge we have, especially for people that know the movies, is they come in knowing he's bad, right? So what we have to do is we have to make sort of the journey to darkness surprising. And we also have to get people behind him in the beginning. We have to get people to empathize with him, to understand his struggle, to root for him. At the same time, we have to be seeding in his ambition, his greed, his need for power, the darkness that is like in there fighting with the goodness, so that when he goes dark, that it feels truthful and it feels honest and it feels authentic.
You know, it's a very common thing these days to look down on prequels and sequels and spinoffs as cash grabs, but just hearing you talk, you're threading a fine needle here. This is a tricky little trick that you pulled, and that's why I was curious if you felt it was an advantage or disadvantage that I went into it blind, because I was able to take in Snow as the version that you wanted to tell him versus having preconceived notions.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, the good thing is I think, you know, for the fans who have seen it that are very familiar with the books and stuff, I think they find that they're surprised that they're rooting for him. You know, I don't think they thought that it could happen, and then they get into this story and in the beginning and they're suddenly behind him and they like him, and they even find themselves going, wait, I know he's going to become evil at some point, but like maybe it won't be now, you know, and they're sort of rooting for him to stay good. And I love that. But, you know, like I said, we really did try to design it to please fans, but also to just work as a standalone film for people who may not be educated in the series.
So I have, well, let me just say that you've nailed that. I think if there are folks like me who go in there blind, I think that they're going to be just as hooked as if they had known the whole story. I've got one more about the Hunger Games before we move on to the rest of your work, albeit it's not about this film. When I bring up the name Philip Seymour Hoffman, what's the first moment that pops in your mind?
The first moment that pops in my mind. I will say that the first moment that pops in my mind was that he left me a voicemail after he saw Catching Fire. So my first time working with him was on Catching Fire, and he only worked with us for, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks or something. And, you know, we were super, super excited to work with him. And he came in and he did a great job. He didn't bond really with everybody in the way that we thought. And, you know, we obviously knew he was going through some stuff that we became much more open about later. But he saw the movie and he loved the movie. And I remember, you know, he leaving me this voicemail about how much he loved the movie and sort of pledging how much harder he's going to work on the next ones to do an amazing job. And I have to say, I saved that voicemail for probably 6 years.
I don't blame you.
And I actually wish I still wish that I hadn't erased it, but I felt like it was time that I had to erase it.
It's okay. I'm sure it still lives where it needs to live,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
All right. So, my man, Constantine.
Yeah.
I feel like I am a ground floor investor in this film. I've been screaming that it's good for close to 20 years now. I'm curious, from your perspective, why you think it's taken so long for culture to realize that.
You know, I don't know. Look. Every job I do, I fall in love with something about it, whether it's the character, the story, the world, ideally all of it. I loved it. I loved making it. I was passionate about it. And, you know, we did okay financially. You know, it was different sort of financial models then.
Was it 70 mil or
what?
100 mil? Because I think the
budget?
Yeah.
The budget was 96 million.
Because you guys made 230. That's pretty good.
No, it's pretty good. And that was at a time, too, where ancillary markets, like, you typically doubled your box office. Like, we made money. It wasn't bad, you know. It's not like a grand slam by any means. But we did okay. But we got, you know, harshed on by the critics. But what I found was over the years, you know, and then when I go out on tour with I Am Legend or something and everybody's got Constantine DVDs and then my next movie, Constantine DVDs, and then Hunger Games, Constantine DVDs. And then there's like Rotten Tomatoes has these, you know, articles on the movies that Rotten Tomatoes got wrong. And Constantine's on there going like, oh, no, this is a gem. People harshed on it, you know, inappropriately. And I don't really know why. I think part of it is I think the world turned around on its opinion of Keanu, and I think Keanu went from somebody that people didn't really respect for a while to being one of the most beloved, you know, actors around, and deservingly so. He's a fantastic guy. So I honestly can't say why. It's great that people love it, and that the fan base seems to have grown, and it's gotten this kind of almost like kind of culty like quality to it now. It's a hell of a lot better of a feeling now than it was when it came out. I'll tell you that. And we're trying to make the sequel. There's been a lot of hurdles. There's just been a lot of hurdles. The sort of control of those kind of dark DC characters, Vertigo characters, has bounced around, and we've tried to sort of gain control. We finally have, and Keanu and I and Akiva Goldsman, who did the movie together originally, are batting around ideas, and we got sort of halted by the strike. But we are actively coming up with ideas to make a part two and a very rated R part two.
Now, is that a conversation that involves James and Peter at DC Films?
I mean, it has, because they're part of, you know, people that have controlled the rights. But really, this is a project that Akiva, Keanu, and I are doing.
And now here's what Constantine, particularly a sequel, particularly in this genre, has going for it that I'm not sure a lot of people know. The original Vertigo version of John Constantine is a outlier amongst comic book characters, as he actually ages in real time.
Yes.
Is this an element that you are going to incorporate in this film?
Without spilling too much, I would say yes. My instinct is, as of now, the idea we have is we would not be pretending that this is, you know, happens 2 weeks after the last Constantine, that this is an older version of John Constantine.
And would you let Keanu keep his hair?
you mean keep his dark hair or go make him go
the long hair?
Oh, I don't know about that. I haven't thought that far ahead, but I'm certainly not making him blonde like the Constantine of the graphic novels. If we do we're doing our Constantine.
I'm glad that you bring that up, because the character itself has gone through quite a big boom since you last touched him, particularly in the DC animated films. Does anything from that stand out to you that inspires you that you would like to incorporate in your version?
I haven't been watching any of the DC animated films, so I don't know.
Very cool.
Interpretations there. I mean, I know that the one that we did was primarily based on Dangerous Habits, that one series of graphic novels. there's lots of elements of a bunch of the other series that I love that we're going to probably pull in and use. But a lot of this, the bulk of this new idea, is one that is being created by me and Akiva and Keanu.
Okay, now, another one of your works that is currently in development that I am psyched for is BioShock. I, again, for a long, long time have been yelling about how great these games are and how adaptable they are, particularly for you, sir, as you say that world building is your thing. How is that process going and where are you guys at right now?
I will say that pre-strike, when we were working, that was the project that I hoped was far enough along that we could have started sort of the research phase. But I will say that we have a draft that I'm really, really happy with and really, really love. Michael Green, who's been a friend of mine, who wrote Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, dude, you're preaching the choir now.
Did it. Like, it's, I think it's really good and it's really exciting.
That makes me psyched, man. I'm sure all fans are going to be psyched to hear that. Did you have any discussions with any actors prior to?
No, not yet. No actor discussions or anything like that yet. We wanted to crack it. You know, what's great, and you know, being a fan of it, is that BioShock has is an amazing game and an amazing world, an amazing mythology, right? There's like the sort of detail of mythology and history and backstory and all that. That is fantastic. The truth is, you know, you have to create a character, right, that does not really exist much. No. Yeah. But so it's like, but that was the thing. So we wanted to spend the time to really make sure we cracked it, worked in the mythology, stayed true to the spirit of the game, much like an adaptation of a book. And I think we really got it.
I'm curious about that because I think the BioShock 1 and 2, the allure of creating that world is reason enough to sign up, right? But BioShock Infinite, the third game, one of the best gaming experiences I've ever had, one of the best narrative gaming experiences I've ever had. The lead character in that, Booker DeWitt, I think is ready-made to be a cinematic lead. I've got to wrap here, so talk to me. Are you incorporating the third game into this? So you're doing it game by game.
Not necessarily. We're starting with one. So the first one is where we start, and we're being very true to that. There have been no talks yet as to how it's going to continue, and in what way it's going to continue.
Gotcha.
There's a lot of possibilities with you know this as being like the possible beginning of a franchise. You can go in many, many directions. In terms of TV, in terms of movie, in terms of animation, like all kinds of things. So, but we're starting with the original.
I've got to wrap here. So I just want to close by saying that your career fascinates me in the term that you started with Constantine, which is a comic book movie in those kind of comic book film dead years, right? In between the sort of X-Men, Spider-Man, and the launch of the MCU. And it has stood the test of time. I Am Legend is, of course, beloved. And I think what strikes me most about your work is that you're able to make IP projects, but strip away the IP and make compelling stories within them. And the IP just provides the sort of entryway into what I find are consistently very fulfilling stories, sir.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
that. I appreciate your time. I did love this film. Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes hits theaters on November 17th. Francis Lawrence. Thank you, Ben.
Awesome. Thank you. Great talking to you.
Okay. Thank you to Francis Lawrence for joining me. I hope Hunger Games fans and Constantine fans and BioShock fans alike enjoyed that interview. We got some great updates from Francis. Make sure to check out the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes when it hits theaters on November 17th. Thank you to my brother Cade at Cade_Onder and all of his great work that he does on comicbook.com and then brings that knowledge over to the show. Make sure to follow him and all of his work. Follow myself at Eric_Ital and the podcast at PostCredPod. We will be back next week. As I said, I am talking to Deadpool 3 director Sean Levy, so we'll have that, a little bit of Loki, and whatever else comes up between now and then. All right, y'all. Peace.